first, I want to just get a show of hands. Who in here works in radio already? Okay. Who has... You guys don't count. Who has hosted a podcast or dabbled with audio online? Cool. Who has edited their own audio before? Okay. So this is awesome. We've got a real skill set in the room already, and keep in mind, I just really wanted to convene this panel because I know there are so many SCJers who are using sound to tell environment and science stories, and I thought it would be a great place for us to all come together and share our learning on this.
How's one here who's never done any of that?
Well, this will be good for you too, don't you worry. Don't you worry. Because fundamentally, you know, this is how human beings share information, is with our voices. Before anything else, this was how we told each other what was going on and what was the important information that needed to get around communities. And I fundamentally think that that's never going to change, no matter how many trappings we add on to online shares and tweets and, you know, working it into all sorts of interactive media. Fundamentally, finding good audio and sharing good audio and stories through sound is going to be critical to our work as journalists for the foreseeable future. So what I want to do today is talk about what makes good audio, how do you get that good audio into your recorder when you're out trying to cover a story, and just kind of stories like that where, you know, it's inane and you're just transfixed with what they're talking about. I think that next time I'm going to pay more attention to that person and start taking notes on how they work, how they share information, because fundamentally anything you put on the radio should aspire to sounding like a really interesting story that you're telling a friend over a beer. That's my fundamental belief in radio storytelling. And even if you're working really complex stuff into that story, so what? If it's not interesting over a cocktail party, you're not doing your job, frankly. My feelings. Okay, so I want to introduce our, another thought before we get going. I believe that audio storytelling is about creating a sense of place and grabbing people by their ears, taking them with you to that place. And when I say that, I mean this could be a physical place or a place in history that you're retelling to that person who's joining you for this story. It could be a memory of an event that's happened. It could be an event or issue that is unfolding right now that you are engaging in conversation with another person about. So just keep tuck that in your back pocket here. We're going to be talking about creating place with audio. So let's start by introducing our panel. I have, many of you saw him just now, leading a great plenary. Steve Kerwood is the host of PRI's program of, 20 years. Steve, how old is Living on Earth now?
It's about 23.
You don't have nearly enough gray hair. I have to tease you about that. And full disclosure, I got my start at Living on Earth after interning at NPR and learned a lot in that shop. They've been covering environment and radio longer than most other people on the planet, I gotta say. And I've asked Steve to focus his comments specifically on doing a good interview about a complex science or environment topic. And I mean that to be, and I hope it will be helpful to anybody who's even thinking about, you know, if you're working on a print story and you have an interesting interview with one of your experts, and the next time you think about the web build-out for that story, maybe you're thinking, if I had just recorded a hello, a goodbye, and one line about who this person is, that audio could have stood on its own as a great web build-out and add to your list, your viewers online. And I've been doing a lot of that, and I think Steve can really speak to the interview, just kind of some quick tidbits and just, you know, his skill set, how he approaches a recording of an interview to help people think about doing that on their own. And this is not necessarily for the airwaves. This is just for your personal web storytelling even. And then we also have Molly Samuel. She's a reporter with KQED Science in San Francisco. I'm a big fan of hers. And Molly can do, obviously, spot and feature reporting. And for today, I've asked her to focus on covering environment and science news on a deadline in a very short format, which is another skill set a lot of us need. 1 minute long stuff, turnaround from, you know, you get the story at 7 a.m., you have to have it on the air by 3 or sooner. How many newscasts a day do you guys have?
We have More than 20.
More than 20 newscasts a day. So when you are working on that time frame and telling a complex story, there is another set of skills that is going to be valuable. So Molly's going to address that and play some audio. And then Peter Thompson was one of the founding producers on Living on Earth, actually, many years ago, and now is the environment editor with The World, also Public Radio International. And I've asked Peter to gear his comments as an editor to what he looks for in a good radio story. So you as, you know, reporters, as you're going out and thinking about your stories, try to think about it through Peter's eyes. You know, what am I going to tell Peter when I pitch him this story or when I go back to my own editor and I'm trying to put together a good feature? So thank you all for joining me on this panel. I work for KUOW NPR in Seattle and a new project called EarthFix, which is focusing on multimedia reporting on environment and science. So I have incorporated a lot of my radio background into maximizing that skill set on the web. So I'm going to start and ask Peter to – oh, and one more note, just some housekeeping. Each of us is going to have 10 minutes. I've asked everyone to pick one or two, in Molly's case, pieces of audio to play for you and talk about. And I really want to have a lot of time for you guys to be sharing your knowledge as well as your questions. I don't want this to just be questions. A lot of people in this room are better at this than I am, and I want you to talk about how you do what you do and share your information. We're going to start with Peter Thompson. Peter, tell us what's your recipe for success?
If I told you, then I'd have to kill you. Well, first, Ashley, thanks for inviting me. It feels a little like sort of a family reunion here, except for Molly, who I've never met. But
like
of course,
a distant cousin.
You know, I started with Steve working full time in environment 22. Years plus ago when we launched Living on Earth, and it's grown old together in a way. And I met Ashley when I went back to Living on Earth after a hiatus of a few years, and she was like just clearly this like firecracker that was, you know, got to grab onto because she's going places.
Another term is pain in the ass.
And a pain in the ass. One of the very first things I learned about Ashley was she's incredibly stubborn. But I've worked with her on a dozen stories since then and keep going back because she's a terrific reporter, even if she's sometimes a pain in the ass as an editor. And Molly, I've never met, but did a lot of work at KQED when I was in California for Living on Earth, so it felt kind of like a second home. So anyway, and it's great to be here. So I'm going to talk just real quickly about sort of what I look for in a pitch, and then I just thought I'd play some tape and talk about how some of these stories came together and accomplished some of what I look for in a pitch. But you probably hear this from just about every editor you talk to in any medium. I mean, what I look for in a pitch is something that is clear, concise, that quickly and compellingly tells me sort of what, where, who, and why. For me, how you pitch a story tells me a lot about how you're going to tell that story. So it really is important that you reflect in that how clear you're able to be about what the story is, why it's important, who cares, and where you're going to take people with it. Because fundamentally, as Ashley said, you know, a good radio story is a journey. You have to be able to take people someplace, have them have an experience, and feel like they learned something, they met people, went places that they hadn't experienced before, that feels authentic, rich, and you do it all in anywhere between 4 and 7 minutes, increasingly shorter and shorter. And also, you know, if you're somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience in the medium or has never pitched to me before, I want to know what your background is and where I can hear some of your best stuff. I mean, that's something I actually don't get a lot from reporters who are new to me, which, again, tells me, like, you have to be organized. You have to tell me why I should spend my time considering your pitch. And part of that is, like, tell me what I can hear that you've done before that's really great. And then in terms of writing in a piece, I mean, fundamentally, radio is a very compressed medium. You have to squeeze as much meaning into every word, every phrase, every sound as you possibly can. And yet, of course, it also has to be, it has to tell a real story and go on a journey. So I look for writing that's evocative, that is, you know, clear and crisp, where people really pay attention to orienting the listener, taking them someplace, moving them well, holding their hand sometimes as they move from place to place with some kind of elements in the script and in the sound that helps do that, because it's also a very ephemeral medium. You can't go back and reread the previous graph. People will you'll lose people if you don't keep them oriented. Doesn't always mean that it has to be completely straightforward. It can be subtle. It can be you can sort of nudge people. You can foreshadow. You can cast back. But these things, you have to help guide people. It also, you have to find a way to deal with complexity, especially in environmental stories. And this is probably the biggest challenge that I continually face as an editor and that my reporters continually face. And sometimes, frankly, you know, I fail completely. I mean, I had a piece on this week on our show that I'm not proud of because it was way too long, it was too complex, and I was trying to, it was an important story, a good piece of journalism, but it just didn't work very well as radio, partly because I just didn't have enough time because I was getting ready to come here. But, you know, this is not something that I have mastered, and I have a magic formula and that I can make happen with every single story. So, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years. It's still a real challenge, especially dealing with environmental stories, which are tremendously complex. So that is always a challenge. Fundamentally, it comes down to the sound. And the sound, of course, is three things. It's the ambient sound, the sound in the environment where you're taking people, and that can be a number of different places within the course of one story. It's the sound of the voices of the people that you're going to be meeting there. And it's the sound of the reporter and the way that you speak, the way you guide people. I mean, Sam Eaton over here is a terrific example. I'm not going to play anything from him because we heard the other night he won some awards. He's really good. But just the kind of presence that you have as a reporter that is engaging and reassuring, but also kind of like, you don't want to be pedantic, but you want to be somebody that the listener feels that they can trust to go with you on this journey. So all those things are key parts of the way that you engage people's ears. And I'm going to just open up and start playing some sound here. Can I have the excuse me. So this first piece is I'm going to play some tape from two different pieces from this reporter, Eric Kneeler, who went to Antarctica for us a couple of years ago, reporting on climate change research down there. The first one was on research into changing ecosystems there. And I'm just going to pick up right at the start of the piece, and I'll tell you a little bit about some of the sound and why I chose it there. After.
About somewhere else in the village.
Oops, wrong one. Here we go. How about this?
Yes.
To see some of the animals of the Antarctic, you have to get out on the ice. And to do that, you first gas up a brand new snowmobile parked just down the road from the main U.S. base at McMurdo Sound. Marine ecologist Dan Costa first came to Antarctica as a graduate student in 1979. Now a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, Costa and one of his own grad students are looking for Weddell seals at a spot on the Ross Sea ice edge, just a few miles from the base. The seals are easy to spot, huge black blobs of fur sunning themselves on the ice that covers the sound. Costa stops the snowmobile about 50 feet away and walks across the snow toward one of them. The animals don't seem disturbed by people. Costa is able to walk right up to one.
This is a young female, and my guess is she hasn't begun to molt.
So in terms of the way that the story was told, I mean, sometimes there are all kinds of ways to start a story. Sometimes the best place is to start at the beginning. And in this case, we're going to this place that is far off, exotic, basically, you know, a mystery to most of our listeners. And so I thought we should, Eric and I obviously worked, you know, closely together on crafting this, but, you know, really start in a very sort of practical place. Like, this is a journey. I'm taking you there. The sound is very simple, but it's also very evocative. It's not too literal. It doesn't, you know, you don't know what that squeak squeak is, but he tells you it's a snowmobile. You figure it's like a gas cap, but it kind of just catches your ear and draws you in and makes you start listening in a way that you wouldn't if it was just a voice or even if it was just the wind blowing across. So it's a little bit mysterious, and he doesn't have to explain it because he's talking about the bigger context. Then there's the engine of the snowmobile, which serves a couple of purposes. One is it you know continues that sense of place and that sense of in, of motion. It starts us on this journey from the place where we begin out toward where the seals are. And again, he doesn't have to refer to, he doesn't have to tell you what's going on. Just like we hear the sound, here we go. It also serves to help compress the storytelling considerably because we hear the engine starting, we hear it stopping. Underneath, it rolls for about 10 seconds just under script. Obviously, the journey out there was a good deal longer than that. It was probably half an hour. But it gives a way to really sort of compress the journey, compress the story, which is something that is extremely important in radio, a very finite amount of time. And then it gets us someplace, and we meet sort of our quarry. It's the first one of the animals that he's looking into. But it starts with just sort of like some very basic stuff, like this is an amazing creature. We're not like starting to get into the science yet. So it's really sort of making people comfortable, but drawing them in and hopefully making them curious about where we're going with this. And then the story starts getting into you know a pretty complex exploration of the way that this ecosystem, a whole lot of different ecosystems there, are changing. And then toward the end tries to sort of then bring that all into like what does this mean for the rest of us, for the rest of the world, because this is so remote, it is so far away, why should we care? And ultimately we have to bring it around to that. The next story was about ice core drilling. And in this story, we actually decided to start at the end. And this is with a piece of tape that originally Eric had at the end because he told it in a more chronological way. And then I heard this sound. I was like, that has to be at the beginning. It's a fabulous sound. It's completely unusual. And it's going to draw people in. In this particular case, the chronology isn't particularly important as long as you're able to set up like what as long as starting at the end tells us why we need to go back to the beginning. I'll just play it. This is a very different story because it's people looking at the it's paleoclimatology. It's looking at ice cores about what happened in the past, hopefully with the to help us look into the future, what's going to happen, what might happen ahead.
Okay, let's go. Let's do it.
The summer research season is winding down on Taylor Glacier, 70 miles from the U.S. research base on Antarctica's McMurdo Sound. So researchers have gathered for a bit of fun before they break camp and head home.
Fire away.
In this case, fun means dropping giant blocks of ice down holes that have been drilled in the glacier.
And the monster.
That's Saturday night on Taylor.
So it's just wacky, amazing sound. And they're just goofing around. I mean, these guys, it's the end of the season. They are just having fun and letting loose after a very intense research season out in the glacier in the middle of Antarctica, and we're gonna wind back and start telling people about like how we got here, what they're doing, why they ended up here at the beginning of the story, with this like just big party on the ice, with this really fun thing. But as I said, I mean, a lot of times in radio and TV, people say you got to go with your hot tape. I think that can be a trap, and that you also need to really be driven by what the story is fundamentally, but at the same time, don't ignore your hot tape. And placement is really important. And in this case, I felt it served the purposes of the story to put it at the top. Like I said, in that case, we moved it. And now I'm going to go to another story, which is more recent, and another case in which there was some really great sound that was really important to the story that the reporter had earlier in the piece and which I put later in the piece, which really sort of it helps tell something about the story, which really kind of in some ways like changes your whole way of experiencing the story by the time we get to the end. And this is a story about leopards and other large carnivores living in very close proximity and great density with humans in India by a reporter named Ari Narayan. And I'll just play a little bit of the earlier part of the story that just sort of starts to fill in some of the
In fact, the area is home to a thriving leopard population. They live in and around the sugarcane plantations that dominate the landscape here. and the cats are well hidden in the dense thickets next to homes and farms.
And not only leopards, but you get wolves, hyenas, jackals.
That's Vidya Atreya, one of India's best-known leopard ecologists. A few years ago, she and her team installed 40 movement-triggered cameras around this part of Maharashtra state, east of Mumbai. And they were surprised by what they saw in the pictures. The leopards were hanging out in people's backyards pretty much every day. The results were published earlier this year in the journal PLOS ONE. The study showed the density of large adult carnivores that it says was never before reported in a human-dominated landscape. But just as surprising, Atreya says, is that attacks like the one on the little girl are very rare.
I mean, these animals can live even among high density of humans without attacking humans the way we expect them to attack.
She says the leopards and other carnivores have adapted to living alongside people, subsisting mostly on stray dogs and cats.
So that sort of gets into the meat of the matter. I hesitate to say that because, I mean, it's very serious because there are attacks, and the story starts out with the story of an attack on a young girl. But then we go through, I mean, essentially this is sort of an amazing story about how that's the real exception. And this is a place where, unlike other parts of the world, where there are, you know, very regular and profound difficulties in places where there's a lot of overlap between humans and carnivores, places from Kenya and Tanzania and East Africa to Denver and the Rocky Mountain front. And what's happening here is really pretty different, but it's also because people are reacting differently. It's not merely because the animals are adapting differently. It's that people have a different ethic about life with carnivores and the threat that they pose. But the story goes along and it talks about the research and it talks about the animals and we hear real voices, but it feels somewhat abstract. But then we get to the end, and I'm going to find out.
Distinct odor of a cat.
Here we go. So,
permanent solution. At a plant nursery surrounded by agricultural fields, there's a distinct odor of a cat. It's coming from a female leopard sitting in a small green cage. As the ecologist Vidya Atreya approaches, it jumps at her and slams against the bar. This leopard is thought to have attacked and killed a 3-year-old girl as she slept with her family in a nearby field. The animal was trapped the next day, and Atreya says there was human DNA in her scat.
She is very likely to be the killer, and in that case, you can't leave her again. No, where will you leave her?
Suspect.
So originally, Adi had that piece of tape closer to the top, and when I heard it, it was like I jumped out of my chair. and I just really thought that it would be... what it does at the end of the piece is it brings it home, like how... These are not cats. These are not bobcats. These are not lynxes. These are gigantic, fierce beasts. And it really kind of brings home how real this threat can be and gives new resonance to the whole thing we've been talking about people adjusting to life with these things in very close density, even with them killing other animals. And this animal probably killed a person. They're not killing this cat. They are just going to keep it in captivity. They have a whole different way of thinking about these things. But this thing is a real beast. And, like, I just thought that was a fabulous exclamation point to put at the end of the piece. And, you know, this is sort of the interplay you do with reporters that, oftentimes the reporter has a great, knows exactly sort of how the story should lay out. But sometimes they don't quite know the power of what they've got. Not that I'm omnipotent, but it's my job to try to figure out how to make the most of what they've got. And so that kind of shifting around of stuff and really figuring out where something is going to have the best impact. I've got a little less than a minute left, and I want to go back just briefly to some writing, because while these are really good stories, the writing is not necessarily the strongest point. I want to just mention a story that won the very first Living on Earth radio reporting award 10 or something years ago. It was on Living on Earth, after I left, by a guy named Guy Hand. It was about the Tongass rainforest in southeastern Alaska. And he's describing this town on Sitka, on I think it's Wrangell Island. And in one sentence, he just manages to express so much. He's talking about the downtown. He's talking about rain. And he says, a sign in the old Harbor Bookstore. I wish I had the tape for this, but I couldn't get it off their website. Steve, work on that. A sign in the old Harbor Bookstore in Sitka says, please don't drip on the books. And just that one sentence tells us so much. It tells us that it's a community that's right by the sea, where there's still a strong, there are strong independent businesses, and it's a place with a sense of humor. And all of that packed into just one little thing. He doesn't go on to explain any of that. It's just one sentence that does like triple, quadruple duty. And that kind of concise, evocative writing, coupled with the sound, and we've been hearing this like drip, 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 drip for, you know, the whole piece up to that point, which is about 45 seconds. That's like my dream writing. I don't get it very often. I can't produce it very often. But just remember that. I could talk about a lot more, but we'll have plenty of time for Q&A later. So, thanks.
Thank you, Peter. God, I got chills from hearing that cat. It's powerful stuff. Up next, we have Molly Samuel, and then I'm going to talk about some feature, what I'm thinking going into a feature, and then we're going to close with Steve talking about interviewing. So, Molly, talk to us about reporting environment and science stories on a deadline. Right, and well, give me a heads up when you want me to play something.
Okay. I feel like I first have to make a pitch for reporting for the newscast. I, in the past couple of years, have learned to admit that I love doing dailies, which is like something that people often don't like and try to avoid being assigned dailies. But it's really fun. I think there's a lot of good reasons to do it. One is there's nothing like the terror of daily deadlines and the like exhaustion at the end of the day, but you go home and you're done. Unlike with a feature, you're not still writing it by the end of the day. Also, I find, at least at KQED, the news editors love it. I mean, they love having science on the air in the newscast. It often sounds really different than this is what City Hall did or this is this fight going on. The Bay Area is a place that's open to a lot of science news and generates a lot of science news. But I don't think that's necessarily something special to the Bay Area. And I also, it's a little bit like a puzzle writing. Our spots are 1 minute, and if it's 1:05, you have to get rid of 5 seconds. There is no flexibility in our newscast to do anything above that. So I think where we don't get to use a lot of sound and play with ambi, there's very likely no ambi in your 1 minute spot. There's a lot of writing, and it's like really you just have to click it in like exactly to get to 60 seconds. If it's a cut and script, it's 45, and it can't be 50. I mean, so I think there's a lot of art, and you can actually do some really beautiful writing if you have more than 2 hours to turn it around, to do a good spot, which I think is fun. I mean, there's also challenges in a one-minute spot on a new scientific paper. You're probably not going to get a critique from somebody else who does similar. You know, it's hard to get a second opinion. And so I think their environment and science reporters really have a leg up from GAs because we own a beat and you know who to call to get that second opinion really fast. And we often have a heads up that this paper is coming or this vote is coming. So it's nice to be on a beat instead of general assignment. The general assignment is fun too. So the first story I'm going to play, unfortunately none of my sound has leads attached because KQED doesn't even we do enough newscasts that they don't even get archived online, so I just have the audio files that were mixed. I don't have the host leads. So this one was aired on the newscast. Did not have a news peg beyond the season. And so this is the other thing the news assignment editors love is when you say, this can air on Thanksgiving. So this is a story, I don't remember what the lead was exactly, but it's, there's a every fall there's a census of the hawks that migrate by the Bay Area, and because of the way the wind patterns work, there's just a funnel of raptors migrating past the Golden Gate. And so it happens for a few months. I went and spent a couple hours one morning watching them do it, and it aired on Thanksgiving. And the other thing about this, so this is 47 seconds long because there's no lead. Count how much sound there's in it.
So this is Hawk Hill.
Joshua Heyman is a volunteer with the Golden Gate Raptor Observatory.
We are on the north end of the Golden Gate Bridge, overlooking the entire bay.
From August through December, volunteers come here every day, including Thanksgiving, to count hawks.
Right below the wire there is a harrier. The common ones with the red tails and the turkey vultures. We also get sharp-shinned hawks and Cooper's hawks. We've got harriers, ospreys, bald and golden eagles, four different falcons.
Numbers from here helped researchers judge when peregrine falcons could come off the endangered species list.
An average day up here is about 60 to 70 hawks per hour.
Migration season is tailing off, but there are at least a few hawks every hour and views from the Bay Bridge to Mount Tam. I'm Molly Samuel, KQED News.
So I think there were five discrete pieces of sound in 47 seconds. So do newscast spots. You can get a little bit. It's possible to get a little bit of sound in. The next thing I'm going to – and and the other thing that I should say with that is Robert Smith from Planet Money, listen for his newscast spots. He is a total artist. I mean, he's a great writer anyway, but – listen for him on the NPR newscast because he, I think, does it better than anyone else. And I, to the point where at KQED, he's like done a couple trainings, and at KQED we're all like, oh, Robert Smith. I mean, he's great. So the next...
Before you go on, can I just say a couple things that I think really work in listening to this spot and aspiring to do better spots myself? There's that one telling line that you put in there. Which line was it? Yes.
Raptors.
You know immediately. No, that one, but also these numbers helped them put it on the endangered species list. And then right there, I know why this matters, right? And it was just one quick line interspersed with all this sense of place. And I don't know about you guys, but I just looked down at the computer halfway through at 24 seconds and was like, I feel like I've been listening to this, like I'm in this place and I've been here for several minutes in the best way possible, not the bad way, you know?
You weren't just holding forth.
Yeah, it was really, yeah, you That's what that sound does for you as a listener, I think, is the time just kind of, you just get sucked into it. So,
and now, something that didn't work well. So,
Molly's a good sport, I ask.
So a lot of daily news is stuff that you're like, do we have to cover this? There's some things that, and this is Amy Quinton from Capital Public Radio is also here in the audience, and you probably get stuck with this every winter month, too, the snow survey in California. once a month in the winter months, the Department of Water Resources goes up there and sticks a tube into the snow, and they tell us how much water we're going to have. You know, it helps us know how much water we're going to have in the summer. They also have digital readings that they're getting constantly. So there's never a surprise in these snow surveys, but we have to cover them every month. It's like housing starts. It's like what you you know when it's coming. You know you have to do it. You already know what the answer is, and you have to explain it. You have to somehow make the people want to listen to it, like instead of just switching to the A's game. And it's not that. So this is a spot, again, that does not have a lead attached. The lead was something like, the annual snow survey shows less than 50% of normal for this year, which is, I mean, even that's not shocking if you're in California anymore. You know, that's not even scary enough for you to care about. So.
Molly.
Yeah.
The Department of Water Resources measures the Sierra snowpack, known as California's frozen reservoir, during the winter and spring to get a read on how much water we'll have for the rest of the year. January and February were both record dry, so it's no surprise that we're coming up short. But state hydrologist Maury Rue says there's no need to despair yet.
We've had 2 years now that we've had big precipitation amounts during the month of March, and I guess it was too much to expect it for the third year in a row. But depending what kind of an April we get, it can make still an appreciable difference.
The Department of Water Resources is saying cities and farms that get water from the State Water Project can only expect about a third of what they're requesting this year. I'm Molly Samuel, KQED News.
Phone tape? I mean, what are you going to do with this? So I don't know. I mean, if any of you all have ideas about how would you – I mean, this is like a totally typical newscast spot, right?
It is, but you know what? The way you read it, made it a little bit more lively. First, certainly before you got to the phone case, but there was something about your read that was a little like irony. It worked for me.
Well, thank you.
Do you feel that including the tape was preferable to maybe like paraphrasing him or saying, you know, da-da-da-da-da says thus and such person in the state government, you know, but we shouldn't despair yet because, et cetera. I know the marketplace sometimes on their morning segment will do that to speed things along. They'll paraphrase instead of using tape or an expert. But you didn't think that was a good option.
Well, you know, I know it's actually a really good question, and sometimes we do cover the snow surveys just with a host reader, you know, and don't bother. You know, probably this was a minute because they were short on news that day and needed a spot. and that sometimes drives that. So, but you're right, and he's a little bit hard to understand, even though he's a great person to talk to. He's a little tough on the phone. So it may have been a good option to have gone to just somebody less charismatic but easier to hear.
I'm curious, are you going more to Skype and things like that for...
No.
No. Why not?
It'd be, ask the engineers at KQED.
okay.
It's just not a direct... We haven't really gone there.
It's harder for spot news, of course.
Yeah, and it's a little bit... I mean, this guy, I don't know how old Ruse is. He is older than I would ask to... Would he please tape himself?
But that is something that's changing.
It is.
I mean, there are more and more technologies that allow you to get much better sounding tape fairly easily, but there are bars, you know, of entry, too.
Yeah, so, and just turnaround time, yeah. I think. If with a feature, it's a little more. But, you know, if this needs to air 2 hours after it's assigned, it's faster to just call it.
Take one or two more questions, and then we'll jump on, and we'll have more time at the end to talk more.
More of the issue because it was a little sleepy. So perhaps what you might have done is like break it up with, you know, give him a bit of what he said in the beginning, then you come back in and you start the writing, and then a little bit more time, like he can finish your sentence or something like that. And so you get the point across, but less.
Is it really cheesy to just have drip, drip, drip? Turning on a faucet.
Not necessarily.
It's not a stupid question.
There was no dripping this winter.
In a case like that, could you use gnats to replace him in your paraphrase?
Well, I mean, I think...
The problem is they come out with these figures, and there's no sense of place. There's not a lot of sound that you can get. I mean, if you're actually there while they're doing the measurements, you can get them walking on. But without that, you just have a press release and a guy you're talking to.
Yeah.
And people do get creative about it, though. You know, like turning on a faucet and saying, this is your water, this is the guy who's going to tell you where it's coming from and how much there is this year might be a cool thing, but sometimes that fails. Sometimes it sounds a little too contrived. It depends on how you deliver it.
Yeah. And Amy and I actually saw each other at the snow survey after this one, the April one, which was a really funny one because there was no snow on the ground. So we were both up there for it, and that was actually like that's some good sound, you know. Like there was actually dry, you know, like walking on dry ground. There was
no part of the story.
Measure. Yeah. So that was a big one.
I had been working with you on this, I would have encouraged you just to do this as a reader, not to give it to the host, but in your voice. My favorite reader in the public radio system is Nina Totenberg when she has to go to the Supreme Court and she's got to tell a story. She's got no tape. But she just, as Ashley took the phrase, she tells her friend who's at the bar about what happened. So I would encourage you to be even a little more personal, not quite the announcer straight ahead, but, you know, a little more of you, and just tell me what's going on.
I think that's Totenberg is genius at that.
We're gonna do one more.
And
Molly, go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say one more thing. Well, why don't we do one more thing, and then I can add one more problem with this story that you all didn't hear.
Okay.
Yeah, I actually like that problem. And tell a little bit about how the survey is done. I assume it's a number of different locations where they get the information. The question in the past was they just before they have the digital response.
They still do.
And then just flew by a helicopter. So there's another sound that you can potentially test how they still do.
Yeah.
Because it's way in the background.
Yeah, I don't know if they still do the helicopter. This is following the manual survey where they actually stick a hollow tube into the snow and then weigh it. So that ends up being... They not everywhere, but you know they fan out across the Sierra, and so sometimes you know time allowing, we'll actually go to it. But this site is 3 hours from KQED, maybe 3.5, depending on you know it's far. So I have two more things to say about the spot. One is it's a pretty complicated thing to even explain what it is and why we care in a minute beyond what the actual news is. And there are a lot of things in environment coverage that are like that are really hard to cover on the newscast. I mean, we follow Delta issues really carefully, and it's like, it takes more than a minute to even explain what the California Delta is. I mean, people in San Francisco do not necessarily know what the Delta is. I feel like we're talking about it all the time. So that's I think that's a big challenge. Another thing that you didn't hear because you didn't hear the lead, the host rewrote the lead and made it not make sense.
That's a problem.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was a 12-second lead probably. He was probably shortening it to sound more natural coming from whatever. I don't know what his motivation was. But that happens all the time, right? And I think that's a special risk with science stories because there are nuances that we're writing into those leads that the anchors don't necessarily know are there. And I think, I don't know what the answer is for that.
Don't they double-check them?
No, not necessarily.
No.
Yeah. Well, but it's also, if they're rewriting it at 6 a.m., I'd just assume they not check with me.
But I think one of the answers is to put as little of that in the lead as possible,
yeah.
And so that it's kind of bulletproof.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't do that completely, but
yeah.
Really.
I think that's one thing. I think another thing is to write into the script, you know, in all bold, all caps at the top, don't change these particular words. I mean, you know, leave directions. And on some level, just like write better leads. Don't throw the lead away. Like the better the lead is, the less likely it is to be changed.
But don't get defensive and not give the host or whatever a lead to say. You know, Peter, you probably get this all the time. You get the piece that leaves no room for an introduction. Mm-hmm. So. Be sure to lead.
As much as I said that, I mean, you know, I have to work with hosts also, and the lead is crucial. For whatever it is, and reporters sometimes send me stories without leads, like, what are you thinking? I'm not even going to look at this until you go back and write a lead.
That's the first thing I write when I write a feature, is the lead. Before I even sometimes have logged my tape, I know this is what's happening in this story. Can we wait until and just get through a couple more before we... start doing a big conversation because I want to spend some time talking with all of you. So I want to talk a little bit about feature writing, and Peter alluded to some of these things. When I go into a feature, I think of it as a three-dimensional endeavor, and there are three components to that. There are the actualities. Those are what the people say, what they tell you. The tracks, you, what you say to the reporter or to the listener, and the ambient sound, or ambi, as we call it in the business. So forgive me if this is, you know, well-trodden ground for all of you in the room, but it helps me to kind of, as I was thinking about how I would explain this to someone, how I approach a story, first I break it up like that, and I almost think about that recipe before I even go into the field to start reporting the story. So what I'm going to do, instead of talking more, I'm going to play a story first that aired recently on All Things Considered, and then kind of talk through those three components. So just be kind of listening for that. Come on. Sorry, guys. NPR website is not responding right now.
Living on Earth relies on your generosity. Broadcast each week.
I'm sorry, guys. I don't know what is going on. It's playing earlier.
Take me back to the time.
It's not any more than the 1970s.
You know what? I'm going to try one more thing, and then I'm going to try to play it from another website.
It's not.
Tell me what it is.
Do you see? It's Chuckling Frogs on NPR.
Jeez.
I'm really sorry, guys. This is a story that aired.
Snowpacks are decreasing across the western United States, and researchers want to know what that means for everything that relies on snow melt, from farms and power plants to the Cascades frog. It lives way up in the mountains of the Northwest and thrives in alpine wetlands fed by melting snow. From member station KUOW in Seattle, Ashley Ahern has the story of this little frog and its shrinking habitat. Things are looking drier than normal in Washington's Olympic Mountains.
It's actually dried out quite a bit already this year. Usually the trail is running with water.
Maureen Ryan is looking for the wet spots. She's a researcher with the University of Washington and an expert on amphibians that live at high elevation. We hike down a steep ridgeline, crisscrossing mountain goat tracks. We're headed to Ryan's lab, you might call it. She studies tiny snow-fed potholes of water cupped in the folds of high mountain ranges in the Northwest. Perfect habitat for Cascades frogs. But as the global climate warms, that habitat is receding.
What's happening to these frogs is in no way dissimilar from what is happening to us, even if we can't necessarily see it. So these frogs are reliant on snowmelt for the water that they need to live.
Just like people in the Pacific Northwest rely on snowmelt to supply water for agriculture, industry, hydropower, and drinking water. Cascades frogs spend most of the year beneath dozens of feet of snow. But for a few short months in the summer, the frogs come to warm, sunny ponds like this one to feed and mate. And while they're at it, they make what some people describe as a chuckling sound. But we'll get to that later. The team fans out, squelching through the muck and slowly scanning the water for the signature dappled brown and yellow heads of the frogs. Most of them are about the size of a child's hand. Their bug eyes peer out at us from beneath the shelter of the banks.
Got a big female now?
Now comes the crazy part. After the scientists have circled the pond and caught about 30 frogs, they pull out a device that looks like the scanner at the grocery store checkout.
So what we have here is a pit tag reader. Just turned it on. You know, it just detects whether there's a pit tag under the skin of the frog, and then if there is, it reads it and gives us a number, and that's an individual identification code for that particular frog.
The team has been inserting tiny magnetic tags, each about the size of a grain of rice, beneath the skin of these frogs for more than a decade. It doesn't harm the frogs.
So we have some frogs that that we've caught that we know are at least 13, 14 years old, might be older. It's pretty amazing.
Along with their frog scanning, the team is monitoring the temperature and depth of ponds like this one. They want to find out when they're drying up during the course of the summer and what that means for the frogs.
Last year we had, you know, a good number of ponds where the ponds dried up before the tadpoles had metamorphosed, and so they didn't survive there.
Ryan worries that with less snowpack and hotter summers, more egg sacs and tadpoles will be stranded out of water. That could ultimately decimate the population, unless they can move into deeper alpine lakes that are more resilient to the warming climate. The problem there is that many of those lakes have been stocked with trout for recreational fishing, and the trout find the Cascades frog delicious. We move on to sample several more ponds. We're seeing lots of frogs, but still haven't heard the alleged chuckling call. Maureen Ryan says we're going to check out one more site. We hunker down in the heather by a snow-lined pond. The frogs are all around us, but they're silent, just staring at us like we're unwelcome party crashers.
One on the rock, one in the grass. There are two that are right under us. And there's another one that's under the bank over there.
We hide, listening. Minutes pass. And then...
These ponds are kind of a microcosm of what's going on in the West. Most of the American West, it gets its water from snowmelt, and that runs our agricultural system and our energy system and our, you know, tap water and every, you know, our industry, all of those things.
The Pacific Northwest has lost about 50% of its snowpack over the last 50 years. In the future, sounds like this could become even harder to record. For NPR...
Okay. So I wanted to play that one because Molly got me thinking, one, about the lead. My hosts were telling me, can we have that chuckling sound to play at the top of the story when we intro it? And I said, oh, hell no, you can't have that. That's my big reveal at the end. You got to have a little bit of theatrical authority when you're telling stories on the radio, and you got to own it because it's your sound. You need to decide how it gets used. A little bit about scene first. I think I'm just going to go one, two, three, scene, acts, and then voicing a story. I knew that there were frogs that were 13 years old before I went into the field because I spent 2 hours on the phone with Maureen Ryan talking about her research. And all of you probably do this already, the pre-interview. And the key is to remember from that, what are the things that made you go, wow, I need to make sure I get that on tape later on. And I need to get that in situ when she is in the field with you talking about these frogs that she's been catching for 13 years. And also, don't be ashamed to ask, what kind of noise does that make? The moment I knew I was going to do the story was when she said, we scan them with a barcode scanner and it beeps. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm out there to do that story for radio, sure. And then when she said they chuckle, I was, you know, pretty happy about that. And it was really, you know, when we talk about radio moments, those moments where you kind of are transfixed in your car, wherever you're listening, and you kind of need to keep listening, they're also recording moments. And as a reporter, I encourage you to kind of think about what those moments are for you when you go into a story. So you're thinking, what is the one moment I need to make sure I experience in the audio experience of covering this story? And for me, it was the chuckling of those frogs. And they were silent the entire day. We walked all over those mountains, and I was just kind of fit to be tied. I was like, I can't go back without the sound of these darn frogs chuckling. And it was one of those moments that I will always remember, lying, hiding behind the heather so these frogs wouldn't see me, because they're mating. They're like, get the heck out of here, do not disturb sign on the door kind of thing. And, you know, it was just one of those moments where, first of all, you know you're doing what you're supposed to be doing with yourself for a living, and you also know that this is going to resonate with listeners no matter what, because you're bringing them the experience of actually getting the sound, not just the sound itself. Do you see what I mean there? Mm-hmm. So you're creating a whole experience around the sound that you're collecting. So I encourage you to think around.
Tension, sort of a narrative tension.
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit of tension, a little bit of anticipation for, you know, knowing what you had to go through to get that sound. For me as the listener, I'm extra excited to hear that sound now, you know. And then the other thing is, there was a great piece of sound in your feature, I'm thinking about ambient sound, where he has the scientists kind of shooting the you-know-what as they're kind of hanging out outside the ice hole. Roll tape, roll tape, roll tape, roll tape. Never stop rolling tape. That's the one thing, and this may be totally old news for all of you in here, but I forget sometimes because you're sort of done, you're tired, and I don't know about you guys, but at the end of a recording day, I'm exhausted in a way that I can only imagine seeing eye dogs are exhausted after they spend an entire day walking for somebody who can't see. I spend the entire day listening for somebody who's not there to hear, and it's really exhausting. And, you know, it's easy to kind of hit that stop button and say, okay, I'm good, I got it. And then they start laughing, or the beers come out, and then they start really talking about what's going on and finding humor in it and being human beings about what they're doing. And that's the tape that really oftentimes makes the story for listeners. Also, the starting up of the engine without anybody talking over it, the door opening when they say hello, those moments that kind of bring you into a scene, that's ambience, and that's gold in a feature. And then the ambient scene also, you should be thinking in terms of action. So when you come back and you're looking at your sound wave, oftentimes you're kind of focusing on the levels, you're focusing on getting the scientist to say all the things that you want them to say, but you also should be thinking about getting the scientist to give you what's called an FX instead of just the sound. You want something that happens, some jump in the sound wave. And I think about that in terms of the scientist doing something. So it's the scientist beeping. It's the, you know, beeping the frog. It's the scientist kind of falling down a mountain as she's getting to the pool that she's studying. It's the action of the scene, and that moves your story along in a way that just the good tape of the scientist explaining their research won't. Because you can do that in your voice. Remember that. Like, when you leave a field recording experience, as long as you've been paying attention and you understand what the scientist is saying, what you really need to have is the audio from the action of that scientist. That's kind of the fundamental part of ambient sound that I think is key in setting yourself up to write a good story later on. Then the tape. How do you pick the actualities? What do you need your interviewees to tell you to bring the story to life? You know, have that two-hour phone conversation first. Understand their research so you know exactly what you need them to say, and help them. Sometimes it really helps them to say it to you first and have to communicate it to you and then develop a rapport with them in the process. So they're kind of going to chuckle with you in the field as opposed to being very kind of tight, zipped up, and, you know, I need to tell you exactly the intricate details of my scientific research. A lot of times, just some quick tips for how I get scientists around that. So you, first of all, you know the science when you go into it, or at least have a pretty good grasp on it, but then don't be afraid to play dumb, because that is sometimes where I've gotten the best tape. And when I first started doing this, I was so afraid of sounding stupid to the scientists that I would ask them the smartest questions I could think of and get the most wonky, boring tape I could ever imagine from them, because I wanted them to talk to me like an equal, not like the average listener who doesn't know what their research is about. And it was really a big watershed when I started just being like, so why should anybody care about your research? Because then they get fired up. I hate asking that question, and scientists kind of hate that question, but you got to at least think about how you're going to get them to answer that question, even if it's indirectly. And then also, always have them show you or narrate what they're doing. So Peter's piece that he played also, you know, he says, this is a seal. That he explains, you know, she hasn't molted yet. This is a female. This is what we're looking at. And that is really helpful in terms of scene setting because it takes some of the pressure off you to describe it. You know, sometimes, and this is maybe an easy trick, but I ask scientists, you know, do you have kids? And if so, how do you describe what you do to them? When you come home from a day of work and your kids, you know, ask you how your day was, what do you tell them? I was interviewing a scientist who studies toxic algal blooms the other day, and I asked him, you know, what do your kids think you do? And he's like, oh, I keep shellfish safe. I was like, thank you for making that basic connection instead of telling me about dinophysis and how it, you know, survives in changing, I don't know, stratospheres of water in the Puget Sound. and then the other, you know, I kind of keep in the back of my mind, why should the guy driving his Audi to Microsoft care about this story? And that is where, you know, I kind of get a little bit almost antagonistic with scientists sometimes, where I ask them, why should people care about your research? Sell it to me, because I'm the first round of listeners. Think about it that way, you know. But also make sure you develop that rapport first before you start being a jerk. And then the last part is you. What do you bring to the story? And that was something that came to me kind of later. It's a confidence thing. Everyone knows the good storytellers at the party. And they're people that, even if they're not confident, they at least convey a sense of confidence, a sense of authority over what they're talking about a lot of time. Or maybe they have a really self-deprecating, amusing humor. Whatever it is, bring that into the way you talk about the science or the environmental issue that you're covering. And don't be shy about, when you're voicing your story, if there's a piece of tape that's funny, have some laughter in your voice when you're voicing it. Sometimes I'll drag my editor into the studio with me to read the tape to me as I'm voicing so that I am responding to the tape. Many of you probably already do this, but it's a really helpful thing to remind if you have someone in the studio, even if it's just another reporter, to come and do it with you. And if there's like little kids chuckling, I've heard this, and I did it once, and I was so mad when I heard the story on the air because the kid was laughing, the parents were laughing, and I came in and was like, the Willifords had blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh, God, you know, like, are you human? Emote, right? Like, or when you're fascinated, be fascinated. Or when you're skeptical, be skeptical. You know, just don't put on the NPR, and I have all the respect for the NPR hosts, but sometimes they sound canned. And they really, you know, they are reading off a piece of paper, and us as reporters really have the opportunity to, we're taking people there. We are the action, you know, that on the radio, and we need to embrace that. And I think you do that through your voicing of a story in a major way. Also, another tip with voicing, if there's action happening and it's speeding up, speak quicker. Speak faster, sorry. And if there's quicker. And write really good. and, you know, if you're hunkering down with a scientist and you're listening, talk quietly. Because the listener is going to be doing that with you, right? So it's a little bit of theater. And I was never a thespian in high school. I didn't hang out with that crowd. I played sports, you know. But I think that there's a real skill set when we think about ourselves a little bit more as performers, as well as hard-hitting journalists that are going to get people to say things on tape that we need them to say on tape because listeners need to hear it. So I think that, as Peter pointed out, writing for radio, the hardest thing I think that I've learned to do in this job is writing complex science for radio. And it really, you read it again aloud to yourself as soon as you write it, and you write it again, and you read it again to yourself aloud, and you write it again until it is understandable to the person sitting next to you who covers business. And it is one of the hardest things to do. And I think for me, you know, you hear the, I call them the radio insecurity bugs. They crawl in your ears when you put the headphones on. And I think reporters can sometimes go into this zombie big word, I'm smart mode. And they forget that that's a turnoff and it's boring. And nobody wants to hear people talk like that. So don't do it. and then it all comes back to your best friend at a bar. This is what happened on my reporting trip today. This is the first thing that jumps to mind. This is the first thing I'm going to tell you when I meet up with you after work. And that's what you're going to tell your listeners, too, because that's what they're hearing, too. 4 p.m. when that newscast files, the first thing that was exciting to you today as a journalist. So those are my three breakdown on feature reporting. And now I want to turn to Steve Kerwood. He is
one of the most experienced hosts and interviewers in the environment beat, and somebody I've learned a lot from over the years in terms of how do you, you're wrestling them. You know, you really, sometimes these scientists need to be sort of wrangled into making a coherent point in a span of time on the radio, and Steve is really good at doing that. So I was hoping you could share some thoughts for how you do that, how you prepare when you put together a really kick-butt interview for Living on Earth.
Okay, is there a... Is that PTO yes. going to reach over here?
Yeah. You might have to pass it down, actually. I don't think we've got... Yeah, we don't have blanks.
All right, well, when it comes to that point...
We can trade seats if you want.
Yeah, we can switch. That's about as far as it's going to go.
This is as far as the pigtail is going. Okay. Well, when we get to that point... Okay. Thanks, Ashley. So what to do to get an interesting interview? Obviously, it depends on where this is going to wind up. If you have... the time and space to edit it, it's a very different game than if it's live. So I'm going to proceed with talking about the opportunity to edit as opposed to live. There's an edge to live that that's a lot of fun. A couple of things, and this applies, I think, generally to what things that one might want to do in the studio. Just like a field piece, an interview is really going to work a lot better, well prepared. I try not to ask too many questions in an interview that I don't have a pretty good idea what the answer is. And the reason for that is I don't want to go down kind of a crazy blind alley with somebody and then, you know, have to pick my way out of it. Again, if it's being edited, you can maybe get around that some, but it's better. So there are two ways. At my shop, often I have the luxury of a producer doing a pre-interview with somebody, because there's a basic principle here, which is which one constantly wrestles with in this business, and that is, once somebody has told you a story, then they've told you the story. And when you go back over it again, they're just not as fresh and as light and as bright and all engaged as they were the first time that they were selling you that story, right? So if you're in a position where you're working with somebody, if you're part of a team, if you can get somebody else to actually have the conversation with the person, and it's fine if you listen, or... at least put some time between when you do that prep interview with them before you're actually with them again. Worst situation, again, this is more field reporting. You know, you show up and you go through this basic background. You haven't done the preparation. And so they're clarifying basic points with you, and now you got to turn around and, you know, get this on the machine. It's problematic. So it's prepare, and did I say prepare? But there are a couple of really cool exceptions about this. If you are getting towards the more emotive parts of things, do not pre-ask these questions. Because you're only going to get the person to cry once. They're just not going to do it again.
You vulture, Steve.
Well, I have an interesting piece of outtake. Tape, and you'll understand why in just a moment. We had Christina Figueres, the executive secretary for the UNFCCC, on the program a while back. And we had done a workup with her, but one of the questions that we didn't really ask her in the workup was how she felt about things. And in particular, she likes to talk about her kids, as do Peter and I, of course. But we didn't ask about that in the pre-interview. When I got to the point of the interview that I asked her, so what hope do you have for your kids? She choked up. She started to cry. Now, I didn't happen to put that piece of tape on the air that day because it really wasn't appropriate, but boy, are we ready to roll with this piece of tape. So when the time comes, but typically find out where they want to go. Now, there's another really core technique, I think, to getting good interviews, and that is, and this is also useful to deal with, anybody here have teenage children? Okay. So Dave Kandow, the Canadian producer, says this, try to avoid asking any yes or no questions. Yeah, ask qualitative questions. So with your teenager, you're not going to say, are you going to be back at midnight? No. I mean, what are they going to tell? They're going to lie to you, right? Sure, Dad, I'll be back at midnight. You ask the politician, are you going to vote for this bill or not? You ask the scientist, well, does this technique work or not? You're going to get, you know, most people are honest and will try to give you a more qualitative response to that yes or no question. But you've also boxed them in to your vision and understanding of the question, as opposed to giving them a qualitative question like, how much do you think this might change? What are the odds that you could vote for this thing? That'll get you a somewhat surprising response, and almost always get you a deeper response. And then, frankly, with the jerks, if you ask them a yes or no question, they might say no, and you're stuck with that. Or they might say, well, yeah. And it's kind of amazing. Dave Kandow, somebody here is a fan of Kandow. I saw a smile. Yeah. Got me to do this a while back, and when I was trying it out with the teenagers, it really did change quality. And then I saw what happened when I dealt with the scientists and the politicians, that give them the qualitative question. Only when you're playing prosecutor do you want to say, you stabbed him with a knife, didn't you? You know, only when you're trying to close in a very difficult situation do you want to do that. Now, I don't mean to take this so far that you can't use the yes or no as a manner of speaking, but the option, you should always give the interviewer the option to tell you what they know. Why are you interviewing them? You want to get what they know and get it on the air. If you want to say what you know, well, then just start talking. The microphone is there. So prepare, have open-ended questions. And then, since you've prepared, and since you're throwing up open-ended questions, listen. They won't always give you the Figueres amazing piece of tape that she starts crying and when you ask her what's going to happen to her children. But there'll be something in there. Now, this is a bit of a dirty trick. But it's smart in certain cases to appear to wrap up the interview early. We're just about out of time. And let me ask you a few more things here. You could even close. Thank you, Senator Smith. I really appreciate you appearing here today. And then keep talking. Keep recording, and then say, by the way, you know, the machine is on, because all this stuff will start tumbling out, and it can be some of the best tape that you get. Now, this is for the tape situation. This is a different game when you're trying to do stuff live. Obviously, quickly, because we're really out of time here, quickly.
We have 30 more minutes. We're going to go until 12:30, just so you guys know, but I do want to get to questions.
Yeah. So, again, it really pays to be prepared so that you know where you're going with the qualitative question. But listen so carefully that it's easy to step in to stop the endless river of blather if it turns into that, you know. So if they really kind of get going, listen carefully so that when you slide in, it's adroit. And then when you step in like that, instead of being a, now this is an interview, this is not a talk show, by the way, you know, where, you know, honestly, I worked as a studio engineer doing talk shows, and I suppose one should never say never, but what I saw, what you have to do in a talk show, in a telephone talk show, it's like ugly. It is disrespectful, because your main job is to get somebody to burp something out and then immediately cut them off. So this does not apply to a talk show. This is for a live interview with somebody. The listening really counts, because you want to get in there and just like kind of push them along. I tried some of that this morning in the plenary. You know, you try to figure out where people are, and then you try to give them something to move it along. And but with the live stuff, you have to be willing to. You're going to lose as often as you win sometimes on the live stuff, and just live with it. The edited stuff you can get right. A couple of things on the edited interviews. Don't forget ambience on the edited interview. This is an acting job. And you are trying to make something that took 10 or 15 or 30 minutes or whatever appear to happen naturally in the 4 or 7 minutes or whatever it is. Or if it took an hour, you want it to appear to have happened in the 12 minutes. So you need almost all the elements that you need for a feature. If you've got if they're at a remote location and there's sound, you need that sound to be able to put under the transitions so that it doesn't sound chopped up. You need to pay attention to the environment that they're in and play to it so that you have no, you don't jar the listener's sense of place. And then last but not least, live or recorded, be comfy when you're in there. Be just really comfy when you're talking to somebody, because that's, you know, Ashley likes to talk about the buddy at the bar. It may be very intimidating, but it's really, the person may be quite intimidating for you, but, you know, you want to hear a situation where the people are enjoying sharing the space. You know, we're in a much larger group than people listen to radio, huh? We typically listen by ourselves, maybe somebody else, and it's an intimate conversation, and we're overhearing. So think of that. And let me try the pigtail for a moment and see if I can have any luck. To give you an example of what I'm talking about. Let's see if I can get this to work here.
You can just sit there, see.
If the beast is queued up at the right spot. See if this goes. Don't want to blast everybody's ears out. Come on. Okay, here we go.
The Environmental Protection Agency, back when it was created under the Nixon administration. He's had a long career in law, business, and politics, and now he lives in Seattle, where I sat down with him at his office.
Thanks for being here.
Take me back to the time of the creation of the Clean Water Act. What was the feeling of the times that made the EPA necessary and made the Clean Water Act necessary?
Well, the sentiment was an explosion of public concern about the environment. It was caused by a number of factors. Rachel Carson's book, which had been written in 1962, had a cumulative effect that was quite pronounced in the country at the time. We had flammable rivers. You already mentioned the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland. We had people in Denver wanting to see the mountains, and people in Los Angeles wanting to see one another. It was a terrible time, and I can remember the first time I moved to Washington, the air was brown as I'd go to work in the morning. There was no industry in Washington. That was all automobile pollution. So people not only heard and saw problems of pollution on television every night, they witnessed it on the way to work. So it really created a demand that something be done. What people have forgotten is that the Clean Water Act was vetoed by President Nixon. That veto was overridden overwhelmingly in both houses of Congress by both parties, even though the election was just 2 weeks away and President Nixon was 20 points ahead of Senator McGovern, his opponent at the time, and still his own party overruled that veto overwhelmingly.
What was that like? What were your conversations like with Nixon?
Oh, they were so wonderful. I had sent him a letter prior to his decision as to whether to sign or veto the bill. spelling out why I thought he should sign it, why I was in support of it.
Okay. So Ashley had...
I did not know he was going to play that, first of all. I asked him to play an interview.
Ashley had Bill Ruckelshaus eating out of the palm of her hand. She knew what he was going to say, what was going to happen in here, in that session. She did a really great job in editing this, so it feels very... So you feel very comfortable. And he just opens and he expands and gives a really wonderful interview, one that, you know, I would think that, you know, if there's a Bill Ruckelshaus Museum, I'll put this in the little archive for him, because he got to tell this story. And she's, you know, and if we have more time, you can hear more of the inside story about wrestling with Dick Nixon to get this thing on. And I'm sorry, Ashley, I didn't warn you about
that. That being said, you can tell how nervous I was in that interview, mm-hmm. because I was really high and I was talking really fast. And I don't have a lot of experience hosting. That was me trying to record myself live, because I wasn't going to get another chance with him the way, you know, when you have a studio interview, you do. So,
but you've done,
self-criticism there.
You've done your homework, though. You had
I knew I was going to ask that question. What was that like, talking to Nixon?
You knew that, and you knew his history. You knew he wasn't telling you any surprises, so you were able to pay attention to him. And so prepare, and then go and be real, relax. He didn't sound up. He sounded, you know, he just loved you in that. You know, he was just so glad to have you there. So those are some of the things that that can work when you're trying to get an interview.
I want to spend as much time as possible on questions, and I don't know about you guys, but I don't mind staying after. I'm really sorry we have kind of gone a little bit long, but let's do this. Who's got questions? Yeah.
I'm Brian. I'm from
Pittsburgh. Yeah, please all do say who you are.
And I've been working in audio since about 2008, and I started off in audio doing mini docs for CBC's Dispatches. Jump. I've always liked sort of long form and deep hanging out and stuff. My question is on sort of outlining, or, you know, what I do, and I don't know if it's right, because I just had to do how I think, and I do boxes. So I'll make a box of a scene, and I'll put within that box what I think I can illustrate.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And then I'll do an arrow to another box, which is like a And I wonder if there's another way to do it, I guess is what I'm asking. Because I like that way, but also sometimes I feel really bound by it, because I'm like, okay, well, now I'm in this scene, and I can only do these things, and I have to move to this scene. And I'm wondering if there's out there different ways of sort of more essayistically moving, or moving from one idea to another. Because we do talk about sound and scene all the time, and it's important in characters. And I wonder about other ways.
Well, one thing that I think is really important, you know, interview, feature, whatever, is to think about the overall arc. So if you have a box, think if you got a train, you know?
Well, that's right, yeah.
What's the narrative arc of this thing? And not to oversimplify, but, you know, what's the brief takeaway from the whole experience? That's not a summary, but what's the takeaway? And that's going to give you your arc, that, and of course, and I assume in your boxes you have a place for the magic moment of sound or interview, whatever it is, and you're building it around that magic moment.
Something else I think about, and this is another Robert Smith-inspired thing. But also, it resonated especially with me because in college I studied the classics. I studied Homer. Is who's the hero? And not the hero like they're saving the day, but who is your character? Who is tying everything together? Who undergoes change? Who learns something? Whose expectations were either met or totally rearranged? And it could just be your totally dry scientist, but if you're thinking that way when you go into your interview, how surprised were you by those findings? Mm-hmm. Then you'll find cuts and you'll find change, even if it's not inherently, you know, kind of beginning, middle, and end story. And so I arrange things when I'm trying to figure out how do I start telling the story. I first review to myself, what is the hero's journey? What's the classic
somebody is in a stable place, something changes, they go seek something out, and they come back changed. Like, that's what a narrative is.
Yeah, I mean, years ago when I was early on at Living on Earth, I did a week-long CPB, Corporation for Public Broadcasting Fellowship at WGBH, and it was with the best in the business telling us how to tell better stories in radio and TV. And the week really distilled down to three words about how to tell a good story, which is conflict, character, and change. Mm. And, you know, obviously you can't always get that perfect sort of flow, but ultimately, you know, especially in a feature story, you really want to beginning, middle, end, and there has to be something that happens and changes, and there's some conflict that people are trying to deal with and wrestle with and work through one way or another. It doesn't mean it comes to resolution, but that there's some change that does happen. I get a lot of pitches that sound to me like a situation. It's like, what's the story? Right. Where is this going? Right. What is happening? I don't want to know just like that this is a bad thing.
You're explaining to your editor why you're giving them a series of vignettes.
Right. Following up on the box thing, and I think that's a really great way of visualizing it. I've never actually thought of it exactly that way, but I do actually, I get a lot of scripts where ideas and voices and characters are kind of spread out throughout the piece, and I ultimately often regroup them into boxes of sorts, I mean, that are within scenes, and in radio you do have to have coherent scenes, but you don't want to sort of wander around and sort of keep coming back to the same ideas and themes, even if they're being developed a little bit more, and to really try to, you know, place people someplace, do your business with a voice that is you're going to spend some time with, get to know a little bit, and then move on to the next place, or, you know, put everything that relates to developing the exposition on a particular key idea in more or less in one place. This is obviously not a hard and fast rule, but it, especially, again, in radio, it's such an ephemeral medium that if you have a voice that comes in here and here and here, someone's not going to remember necessarily who they were by the time you hear them for the second or third time later in a piece. They're not necessarily going to connect the dots between the development of a particular idea if it's spread out over the piece. Sometimes you can't do that, but to really try to put things in boxes. I mean, those boxes have to be beautiful. They have to have nice transitions into the next box, and they have to have things that foreshadow and recall. But to really sort of think about how you're going to group your ideas and your characters and your scenes.
And one more thing I love that idea. I'm totally going to use that. And I would also say embrace it, because it helps. There's that fear of that the listener's not following you. And one thing that I've just started really enjoying and using in my stories is the fade to black. You're embracing the box, basically. You're saying, I'm done with this scene. You've heard this person say this. Now we're not hearing anything for a minute. And then the scene sound is going to fade up, and I'm somewhere new with you, and we're in a new box. And that's okay. You know, you're kind of – I hate that. My pet peeve on the radio is when the reporter does a feature, takes you somewhere, meets the family, blah, 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 and then says, back at the Williford's house. And I'm like, what are you talking about back at the – you weren't back at the Williford's house. You were there once. And if you want to go back there again, just play me the sound and take me there, for Christ's sake, you know? Like, so I like the box. I think that's cool. Let's take more questions. Yeah.
Hi, Emily Gertz, freelance. I'm curious, how much, and this is for Peter, but also if anyone else has input, how much reporting do you feel someone like me would want to have done when I come to you with a pitch? Because, you know, there's sort of that balance between, like, obviously I'm going to pre-report a good deal of it, but when it comes to, like, taking the time to go out and collect the sound, if I don't have an assignment, that's a little harder to justify.
Check out, yeah.
In terms of the work balance to income. So, but on the other hand, if that is, on the other hand, going to increase my success rate with pitches, that's something to know as well.
Well, as a rule, I do not take stories from people who've already reported the whole story and haven't been in touch with me about it, because we can't have any conversation about what we want. We have to work with what you've got. And most often, that's not going to work. With some of my better reporters, you know, I know I can trust them. I know that they've got, you know, we can make something work. But having said that, I want a reporter to be really deeply familiar with what the story is going to be and be able to sell me on it, and that they know, you know, there's always this balance between preparing, over preparing yourself and under preparing yourself, but that you need to have a clear and deep sense of what the story is, why it's important, who you're going to talk to, where you're going to go, even sort of, you know, maybe what the story arc is going to be. Then you got to go out and report the story, and you got to be able to respond to unexpected things, because they always happen, and they should. If something unexpected doesn't happen in the story, you're not doing your job. It's not a courtroom, although, you know, in some interviews, it's still, you know, you want to ask questions where you know the answer, but sometimes you also want to ask questions that you don't know the answer. And so you have to be able to respond, you know. You can't rewrite the story in your head before you go out and just stick to that. But so basically, you know, I want to get a pitch that tells me I know, you know, why the story is important. I know roughly who I'm going to talk to, where I'm going to go with it, what's, you know, why it needs to be told now, how it's advancing, you know, how this has been told elsewhere before, or if it's brand new, you know, why now, but not having gone out and actually done it yet. So that's...
Another thought you might want to try if you haven't done a lot of radio is your next print story, try recording some sound and just try it. And that way you're not expending money that you wouldn't be expending otherwise to try and do radio, because it's kind of expensive to get into in terms of getting equipment, although less so now with new technology. So, and then you'll have sound and you'll have a feel for kind of what you're doing when you're out there with the audio. And I think that will really help even in just thinking how you would write that story. I think more and more we're seeing print reporters getting into public radio. It's a big thing that's happening at NPR and the newsroom there. And that skill set is hugely valuable. Radio is not rocket science. You know, you can do it. When you're a smart reporter, it's just figuring out how to re-manipulate the information.
Well, but, sometimes it is rocket science. Sometimes okay. It's really difficult. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of print reporters who've tried to make the transition and have just failed.
Yeah, sure.
And I've listened to a lot of reporters who have made the transition and have still failed because they just never... sound convincing. It doesn't feel natural to them. So, I mean, it is. There's so many elements to it that go beyond what you're able to do for writing and for just print. And you know, print is fabulous. And but they're not necessarily. It's not easy to make the jump for everybody.
And I think it's important to. Some things are a lot harder than others. So don't try to scale Mount Everest if you can't, you know, go up Mount Tamalampus or whatever it is.
Tamalampus.
Because you know, many years ago, back when there were still dial telephones, when I first went to NPR from television, I'd been in print for many years, but it was in television before I went to NPR. It took Deb Amos and Alex Chadwick about 2 years to really beat into me what you have to do for a true documentary. It was a long time before I could, in my head, understand, all right, I'm going to need these elements. It was a couple of years. But shorter form stuff, where it's just, you know, a little bit of actuality and some tracks or whatever, that is, you can get to that. That part isn't rocket science. But understanding the elements that you're going to need to have this really work, especially absent an editor saying you got to get this, and this, like the field piece that you played, it takes a while to get there. Because Ashley touched on this. You know, the core thing about radio is it does, you know, it's just the voice. This is the primal way that we communicate. We hear the voice in the womb. And they say it's, you know, sound is the last, you know, the last senses to work before we check out. And so when we hear, our brain is programmed to imagine what these sounds are associated with. When you write, you are telling the reader what something means with the word. You define that. So you say, the mayor says taxes aren't going up. And then you write parenthetically, but last year they went up, or... And you can't say directly the taxes aren't going. The mayor said taxes are going up, but he's lying when you write. But in the interview with the mayor, you catch the mayor in the hallway. Mr. Mayor, taxes are going up this year, and he says, "No." So that slice of character tells a lot of story. But remember, your listener
is imagining what the mayor and even what you look like. Thank God, because I have this face for radio, right? And this is a funny joke, and this is, I don't know how many people have approached me, oh my God, you're black? They'll say. So, people imagine. People love to imagine. And so playing, I mean, it's not that they love it. It's how we're constructed. It's just who we are. So you are, this is what you're feeding. So think about how you build a character, right? The middle C of Peter's thing. So for radio, of course, the character is largely the voice. I mean, there are other things. You can hear some certain movements and the content of how they answer is building their character. But there's a wonderful element that's in their voice. So mic it tight, mic it well. When you find somebody in the field that has an intriguing or interesting sound, grab them. They'll just be wonderful. I don't know, you know, it can be embarrassing because you've got the grand poobah scientist, but the aide is the one who's got the sound. And go for that. And then the piece really starts to come alive. I'm sorry, I'm taking too much time on this, but this is just this is the fun part of this.
We are running a little low on time. I'm happy to say, and forgive me if you guys have to go, but I want to give Lita a chance to say something quickly, and then I want to take one more question from Roma.
And I also want to let people know, I have a few brief documents that are basically like distilled versions of this panel, writing for radio, collecting sound for radio. Two of them I wrote. One of them was written by Sandy Tolan, who's one of the best in the business. I'm happy to send them to anybody who wants them. So.